Chapter 16. Mr. Sideways. The old boys in the villages around Granny Weatherwax's cottage had swiftly taken a liking to Geoffrey. They respected Nanny Ogg and Tiffany, of course, but they really liked Geoffrey. They would taunt him sometimes. After all, he was in a woman's business. But when he got on his broomstick, sometimes even with his goat perched behind him rather than harnessed to its little cart, and whizzed away to the horizon, they were speechless. Even when he was really busy, he always had time to stop and chat, and there was always a brew on in any shed when he came by, and a broken biscuit for Mephistopheles. The old boys were fascinated by the goat, but wary, nonetheless, after the day when someone gave it a drink of ale just to see what would happen, and to their astonishment, Mephistopheles danced like a ballerina and then kicked a young tree so hard that its trunk split in two.
"It's like those folk who do mushy," said Stinky Jim.
"I don't think that's the right word," said Smack Tremble. "Ain't mushy something you eat out in foreign parts?"
"You mean, one man he go up, he go down," Captain Makepeace said. "A way of fighting."
"That's it," said Stinky Jim. "There was this fellow at the market in Slice who could do that. There's a lot of people in Slice who can do that kind of thing," Smack Tremble added with a shiver. "Odd place, Slice."
"Quite correct. As the common joke says, most inhabitants of Slice are more than one slice short of a loaf." They sat and thought about Slice for a moment. You could find anything at Slice Market if you looked hard enough. Famously, a man once sold his wife there, where the phrase bring and buy was taken literally, and he went home with a second-hand wheelbarrow and felt he had the best of the bargain. Then they looked at the remains of the sapling and agreed that Mephistopheles was indeed a remarkable goat, but perhaps it would be best to leave his diet alone. The remarkable goat himself stoically chewed his way through the long grass by the pub fence as though nothing untoward had happened, and then trotted off to find Geoffrey. On this particular fine morning, Geoffrey was at Laughing Boy Sideways' house. Tiffany had been treating a particularly troublesome bunion of his, which had resisted her ministrations for weeks. She had been considering breaking her rule and using magic on the thing, just to be done with it, when Geoffrey decided to pop in to see Mr. Sideways on a day when Tiffany was away at the chalk. He found the old man by the back door of his cottage, just about to hobble down the path to the old barn. Instead of heading back into the cottage, as he would have done if Tiffany had called, Mr. Sideways beckoned to Geoffrey to follow him down the path toward the rickety barn. And it was as Geoffrey watched the old boy struggling painfully along in his old army boots that he noticed something very wrong.
"Well, dang me," Mr. Sideways said, when Geoffrey prized the offending hobnail from his left boot. "If I'd known that was what the trouble was, I'd have dealt with the bugger myself."
He looked at Geoffrey with bright eyes.
"Thank ye, lad."
Old Mr. Sideways lived on his own, and had done so for as long as anyone could remember. He was meticulously dressed, and in the city might have been described as dapper. Apart from his work overalls, which were washed regularly, but were streaked with paint and oil, he was always spick and span. So was his little cottage. The living room, which he kept immaculately tidy, had paintings of people in old-fashioned dress on the wall. Geoffrey assumed these were portraits of Mr. Sideways' parents, although he never spoke of them. Everything the man did, he did carefully. Geoffrey liked him, and even though he was a very private man, he had taken to Geoffrey. The shed Mr. Sideways had constructed adjacent to the old barn was also immaculate. Every shelf was neatly stacked with carefully labelled old tobacco tins and jars. His tools were hung against the walls, neatly ranked by size. They were clean and sharp, too. Tiffany had never been allowed beyond Mr. Sideways's living room, but Geoffrey had soon been welcomed to share a mug of tea and a biscuit in the shed by the barn. Each one of the sheds Geoffrey visited on his rounds of the old boys was different, expressing the personality of the occupant, unfettered by female intervention. Some were chaotic, with piles of scrap and half-made objects scattered about. Others were tidier, like Captain Makepeace's shed, which was full of paints, brushes and canvases, but still had a clear sense of order. But no one was as tidy as Mr. Sideways. And then Geoffrey noticed something missing. All the other sheds had at least one work-in-progress visible, whether it was a half-made bird table or a stripped-down wheelbarrow with a new shaft. But there was nothing like that to be seen in Mr. Sideways's shed, and he evaded the question when Geoffrey asked what he was working on.
"What are you up to, Mr. Sideways?" Geoffrey asked. "You look like a man who has been thinking, and I know you are a canny man at that."
Mr. Sideways cleared his throat. "Well, you see, lad, I am building a machine. I've no interest in bird tables or mug trees and the like, but machines now." He paused, then looked carefully at Geoffrey. "I've been thinking that it might be useful, what with the troubles folks are having." Geoffrey sat calmly, waiting for the old boy to finish his tea and reach a conclusion. Eventually, Mr. Sideways put down his mug and stood up, brushing the crumbs off his lap. He swept them up with a small pan and brush he clearly kept just for that purpose, washed out the mugs, dried and stacked them neatly on a shelf, then opened the door. "Would you like to see, lad?" While Geoffrey drank his mug of tea with Mr. Sideways in Lanka, over in the chalk, Letitia, the Baroness, was sipping tea daintily with Magrat, the Queen of Lanka, who had arrived unexpectedly on her broomstick. A broomstick flying the pennant of Lanka, the two bears on black and gold, just to make sure that nobody could be in any doubt that this was a royal visit. She had arrived, bearing a bunch of roses from the castle, throwing Letitia and her staff all in the tiswas, and Letitia flapping about the cobwebs, some of which she had even managed to get tangled in her hair. Magrat had smiled at the rather shaky-looking Letitia, and said, "I'm not here as queen, love. I'm here as a witch. I always have been one, and always will be, so don't worry about all the pomp. You know how it is, it's just expected. Bit of dust here and there is nothing. Some parts of my castle are full of dust, I'm sorry to say. You know how that is, too." Letitia had nodded. She did indeed know what it was like. And as for the plumbing, well, she did not want to even think about how old-fashioned the castle was. The ancient privies had a habit of gurgling at the wrong time, and Roland said that if he had the time, he could create an orchestra from the bangs, gurgles, and clankings that sometimes followed his morning visits. She had rallied the troops, though, and now the two ladies sat side by side in the castle hall, breathing in the peaty fumes from the fireplace. It was always, always cold there, even in summer, which was why the fireplaces were so big and ate several small trees at a time. The kitchen staff had brought out a hasty tray with tea and little snacks, and yes, the sandwiches did have the crusts cut off to make them appropriately dainty for the two noble ladies. Magrat sighed. She really hoped Letitia at least asked for the crusts to be given to the birds. There was also a plate of rather wobbly cupcakes. It appears to be a fact of life that if two or more well-born ladies should gather together, cupcakes are essential. Otherwise the ceiling might fall on them. "I made those," Letitia said proudly, "yesterday, from a recipe in Nanny Ogg's new cookbook. You know, a lot of what you fancy makes you fat." She coloured a little, and her hand crept self-consciously up to her bodice, where it was clear that when curves were being handed out, Letitia had been at the end of the line. Magrat took a cake by its little case rather carefully. Some of Nanny Ogg's recipes could include unusual ingredients, and she already had three children. She nibbled at the little cake, and the two ladies exchanged the usual pleasantries, with Magrat admiring a watercolour Letitia had painted of the chalk giant up on the downlands. It was surprisingly detailed, especially in the no-trousers area. Nanny Ogg would definitely have approved, Magrat thought. Then she got down to business. "Well," she said, "I'm sure I don't need to tell you, Letitia, but up in Lanka we've had enough of the elves. Something must be done." "Oh, dear, I'm sorry to say that Roland is about to write to Mistress Aching about the wave of elf raids and ask her what she's proposing to do about them. There have been an awful lot of complaints, you know, and he's out inspecting the damage." Letitia sighed. She understood that her husband, looking at the damage, comprised more than just inspecting the aftermath and saying, "Tsk-ts." And how long has this been going on? It needed to include other things to make his tenants feel that someone was doing something about it. And Roland's wife had impressed on him that this was not just a matter of being seen, but that rolling up his sleeves and getting stuck in alongside his men was good for morale. Even better if he bought a round in the pub when the day's work was done and became not just the boss but almost a friend. "We've got men enough here, no doubt about it," she added, "but most of the time they are working on the farms. It would be appreciated if other witches could help." "And unfortunately that means us," Magrat said smartly, with the emphasis on the us part. Letitia looked embarrassed. "I'm not a proper witch, you know." Magrat looked at the Baroness. There was something terribly soggy about Letitia, as if you could pick her up and wring her out. But witches came in all shapes and sizes. Both Nanny Ogg and Agnes Knitt, for instance, were decidedly plump. a very kind term for Agnes, used only by her friends. While long, tall, short, fat Sally went up and down according to the tides, and there was no doubt the water could be powerful.
"My dear, you are selling yourself short," she said. "And I know what it is. I believe, my dear, that you are frightened that you wouldn't make the grade as a witch. We all went through that. Girls normally do. Tiffany has told me all about you, you know.
As for me, I don't know what I would be like in a house with a screaming skeleton. Were you not the girl who gave a headless ghost a pumpkin to carry round, and handed a teddy bear to a screaming skeleton for comfort? You don't think you're a witch, but every part of my soul says you are. I wish I'd had your opportunities when I was a girl."
"But I am the Baroness. I am a lady. I can't be a witch."
Magrat made a sound like and said, "Well, I am a queen. That doesn't stop me being a witch when needs must. This is the time, my dear, when we stop thinking about ourselves and who we are and get down and dirty. Tiffany cannot fight the elves on her own, and this is a war, and it will keep on going unless everyone pitches in."
Her words flowed in and filled Letitia.
"You are right, of course," the young Baroness said. "Naturally, Roland will agree with me, as he always does. Count me in."
"Good," said Magrat. "I have got some chain mail, which I think is your size. And now, how soon can you leave for Lanka? I believe we are meeting to discuss the situation. Can you ride a broomstick, or do you need a lift?"
Tiffany straddled her broomstick. She had heard in the village that old Mrs. Pigeon was near her time, and a wave of guilt had flooded through her. Yes, she had two steadings. Yes, she had to work out what to do with Nightshade. Yes, she had no time to rest. But she hadn't seen the old lady for over a week, and in a week an old lady could fall through the cracks of life. Nightshade was perched behind her, her sharp eyes noting everything. Noting how the Pigeon family had only the smallest plot of land, with soil so poor it was a wonder they got a crop out of it at all, their fortunes depending mostly on the little flock of sheep they had in their field by the stream. Sid Pigeon, the youngest son, was there, looking much smaller somehow without his shiny railway uniform. To Tiffany's surprise, he'd brought a new work friend home with him. Nightshade recoiled.
"A goblin? In their house? Stinking?" she said with distaste.
Tiffany felt like kicking her. "A very respectable goblin," she said smartly, though it was true that she could smell the goblin as soon as she went into the house, even over the layers of other smells happily living in that very dirty home. She nodded to the goblin, who was sitting with his feet up on the table, eating what looked like a chicken leg that others, possibly the cats, had had a go at before him.
Sid's friend.
"Of piston the steam, mistress," the goblin said cheerfully. "Works with the iron and steel, I does."
"Tiffany," Sid said urgently, "have you come to see Granny? She's in bed upstairs." Old Mrs. Pigeon was indeed in her bed, and it didn't look to Tiffany as if she was likely to be getting out of it ever again. The old lady was little more than a wrinkled set of bones, her twig-like fingers clutching at the edges of a faded patchwork quilt. Tiffany reached out and held one of her hands, and did what she could for the old lady, calling the pain out of the shrunken body. And all hell broke loose downstairs.
"Sid, them pesky fairies or whatever, they've only gone and fouled the stream. It's all yeller, and there's dead fish floating in it. We've got to move the sheep, now."
Mr. Pigeon sounded desperate as he called to his son. As a thunder of boots left the house, Tiffany held her concentration, drew more pain from old Mrs. Pigeon, and then Nightshade was at her side.
"I don't understand," she said. "That goblin went with the humans."
"It's called helping," Tiffany said smartly, still trying to hold on to the pain she had taken from old Mrs. Pigeon. "Remember?"
"But goblins and humans don't like each other," Nightshade continued, puzzled.
"I told you, of piston the steam is Sid's friend, but this isn't about liking," Tiffany said. "It's about helping each other out. If the goblin camp was on fire or something, the humans would help them." She looked down at Mrs. Pigeon. The old lady was falling into a sleep now. "Look, I need to go outside for a minute," she said. "Stay with Mrs. Pigeon, would you? Let me know if she wakes again." Nightshade was horrified.
"But I can't. I'm an elf. I've already carried that basket. I can't help another human."
"Why not?" said Tiffany sharply.
of Piston the Steam just did. Are elves less than goblins? But she had no time to waste, so she headed downstairs and threw the pane out into a pile of stones laid ready for building into a wall. It made a rather unfortunate loud bang. There had been quite a lot of pane, which is probably why, when she got back upstairs, Mrs. Pigeon had woken up and asked for a cup of water. The old granny was staring up at Nightshade, a smile on her gummy face, as she reached out for the cup.
"You're a good girl, you are," she was saying weakly. "A good girl."
"A good girl? A good elf?" Nightshade put her hands to her stomach. "I think it is beginning," she said softly, looking up at Tiffany. "I feel a sort of warm spot here, in my stomach, a little glow." Tiffany smiled, laid a gentling hand on Mrs. Pigeon, and then took Nightshade by the arm. "I need your help," she said. "Elves have put this glamour on the stream, and it runs past several farms. Can you put it right?" She paused. "As your friend, Nightshade, I'm asking for your help. The Feagles can help with the sheep, but to remove the glamour, this is something only one of your kind can do." Nightshade stood up. "A glamour from Peas Blossom," she said. "This will be no trouble to remove. That elf is weak. And yes, I will help you, Tiffany. You are my friend." The word sounded odd in her voice, but there was no doubt that she meant it. So she went down into the fields with Tiffany, past the skittish sheep in the yard, some of whom, courtesy of the ever-present Feagles, had just broken the county record for stream-to-yard time, one young lamb actually doing so on one leg, and down to the boiling water, where she did indeed put it right, and the tiny little glow inside began to smoulder. The old barn behind Mr. Sideways's shed was full of miscellaneous weaponry, souvenirs from many conflicts, lovingly oiled and meticulously labelled.
"I've been collecting 'em," Mr. Sideways said proudly. "Every campaign I've been in, and more besides. You should always keep your weapons handy. I mean, I don't say anything bad about trolls and the dwarfs, but we fought them more than once, and so I say you always have to make sure. Somebody says something, and before you know it, we're knee-deep in dwarfs. They give you the up-and-under. You can't trust them with the up-and-under."
Geoffrey looked around the walls of the barn in astonishment. The machinery of death was everywhere if you looked at it properly. And there he was, this smiling old man with whom he'd just been sharing a cup of tea, eyes sparkling, ready to face the foe, especially if it wasn't human. And he was known as Laughing Boy. What would he have been like if he had been known as Scowling Boy?
"I can turn a lathe as good as anybody," Mr. Sideways said.
"A lathe," said Geoffrey. "You get swarf, don't you?"
"Oh, yes. Terrible stuff if it gets in your eye," he smiled. "And it could be useful for something."
There was a moment when he almost led Geoffrey back out again, but then he could not hold it in any longer. He had to show the boy what he'd been working on.
"Come, lad, have a look at this. It was going to be a secret until it was finished, but of course I can tell you."
At the back of the barn there was a huge shape covered with a tarpaulin. Mr. Sideways led Geoffrey over to it, reached up and gave the tarpaulin a tug. As it fell away, Geoffrey gasped. The machine looked like a great metal grasshopper, with a counterweight at one end and an enormous leather sling at the other. As he gazed at the machine in astonishment, Geoffrey realised that he had seen something similar in the books Mr. Wiggle had showed him at home. He said, "This looks dangerous."
"I hope so," said Mr. Sideways. "I've always wanted one of these, ever since I saw them in action. The dwarfs had ones a bit like this, which could throw a troll flat on his back. Those dwarfs know a thing or two, I must say, and I'm very big on gnome defence." He coughed. "Got the idea to build one after I'd been watching the lads down the pub do the stick and bucket dance."
A dance that should only be performed when no women are nearby. If you saw it, you would know why.
"So I see," said Geoffrey. "Captain Makepeace is very impressed," Mr. Sideways added. "So me and the boys are going to try it out tomorrow, but nowhere anyone can see us."
These old gentlemen have certain qualities, Geoffrey thought. Just because they are old doesn't mean they can't be powerful. Chapter 17. An Argument of Witches. Through the unbarred door
Lord Lankin creeps into a crumbling old manor house, up the creaky stairs, snuffing out the candles and the sconces as he passes. He opens an unbolted door and prowls into a nursery, where a young nursemaid, rocking a cradle, looks up, gazes into his eyes, and then pulls a sharp pin from her basket. Sitting in the great hall at Lanka Castle with their allies and friends, Tiffany and the witches of Lanka contemplated the construction of a battle plan. It had taken some effort to get everyone there and settled down. Geoffrey had done a marvellous job rounding up reinforcements from all over, flying hours in every direction with Tiffany's message to every witch she could name. Even blind Mrs. Happenstance and long, tall, short, fat Sally had turned up, with Mrs. Proust from Ankh Morpork, and there was a group of younger witches too, Anagramma Hawkin, Petulia Gristle, Dimity Hubbub, Harrietta Bilk and others. Under Queen Magrat's watchful eye, Letitia ticked them off Tiffany's list as they arrived. Having a queen backing you up was a good thing, Tiffany thought, as Mrs. Earwig came in and started bossing everyone around. Magrat swiftly put a stop to that, for even Mrs. Earwig found that she couldn't argue with royalty. But dealing with witches altogether was like carrying a tray full of marbles. Witches were very good at rubbing one another up the wrong way, and little feuds turned up and went away and disappeared and started again. It was silly, and everybody knew it, but they couldn't help themselves. Geoffrey came into his own on occasions like this. Whenever bickering broke out, he was there with the perfect word or a sympathetic smile. Seeing his calm weaving, doing its subtle work was a joy, Tiffany thought. You could almost see the calm coming out of his ears. "Ladies," Tiffany said, calling the meeting to order, "here's the problem. The elves are back again, this time in force, and if we don't stop them soon, things will get very bad indeed. I know some of you have encountered elves before," she looked at Nanny Og and Magrat, "but many of you have not. They are a formidable foe." Nightshade was standing at the side of the hall, almost too demure in her dairymaid's dress. She didn't seem very formidable, but a few of the older witches were eyeing her as though they had just encountered the bad smell. Mrs. Earwig tutted and looked as though she was about to say something, but Petulia got there first. "Tiff, are you sure that it's wise to have an elf here listening to this?" she asked.
"Don't you worry, my girl," Nanny Og said. "If our little friend tries nothing, there will be fireworks and no mistake. Certainly no more elf."
"The last time this happened, didn't the King of the Elves intervene?"
Anagramma Hawkin asked, looking at Nanny Og.
"He did indeed, but he almost didn't. Tiffany's been to see him already, and it seems old Orny ain't interested," Nanny answered. "Can't rely on him in any case."
"Time moves differently in his realm," Tiffany explained. "Even if he did decide to do something, it might be now, or next month, or next year."
"What about the wizards?" asked another witch. "Why aren't they here?"
Nanny snorted.
"Ha! That lot! By the time they got a spell ready, the elves would be over the ramtops and far away."
She adjusted her position and sniffed.
"No, this is witches' business. Them wizards have all got their bums on chairs and their noses stuck in books."
She said this last word with a sideways glance at Mrs. Earwig, who was, of course, known for her love of writing. Most everyday working witches believed the best use for a book was on a nail in the privy. Magrat cut in quickly.
"We also have all the support of Lanka that Verence and I can muster."
"Well, that's my Sean," said Nanny with satisfaction.
Sean Og was the army of Lanka, as well as its bottle washer, butler, gardener, trumpeter, and, a role Sean would have liked to lose, the man who checked the guard robes and removed all the night waste.
"And I reckons our Jason can provide us with a few horseshoes, being as he's the blacksmith,"
Nanny added, for those who might not know. Geoffrey coughed.
"I've been working on a few ideas with some of the older gentlemen," he said softly. "We have something I think might be useful."
"And there's Hodgesarg," said Magrat.
Hodgesarg, the royal falconer, was a surprising asset, since elven glamour didn't seem to work on him, probably because he spent so much time with his beloved birds that a part of his brain was a falcon by now, and hence unprepared to share space with any other predator. It was generally believed that this was also what stopped the birds from pecking out his eyeballs.
Mrs. Earwig laughed confidently. "So what is the problem, may I ask? There are plenty of us here, surely more than enough for a few elves."
She looked scornfully at Nightshade. Nanny Ogg exploded.
No, there's not enough of us. How many witches have we here?
She looked around the room.
10, 12 maybe. More if you include Geoffrey and Letitia, and the young girls still training, but only half of us, being senior witches, were as much real experience. The elves are sneaky. They'll have the glamour on you before you know it. They come quietly, like a silent but deadly fart, and they get you before you can pinch your nose. Even Esme Weatherwax could barely withstand the power. She forearmed, and you all remember what she was like. They didn't get past her, but it was a close thing. Ladies, these here elves are horrible. We're right to be fearful. They do things to you. Get at you.
It happened to me too, said Magrat. The glamour makes you feel small and worthless. Those of us who have faced it before can't warn the rest of you enough.
I fear you are exaggerating. There's nothing glamorous about that,
Mrs. Earwig said scornfully, pointing at Nightshade.
Well, you've certainly never met no fairy. If and you had, you would have scars,
Nanny spat. She had turned an interesting colour, and Tiffany intervened quickly before sparks really began to fly.
Ladies, ladies, I think it would be useful to have a little demonstration of the power of an elf. Nightshade, would you be prepared to give us a taste of your glamour?
There was a collective intake of breath as the assembled witches realised what Tiffany was suggesting.
Be careful, Nightshade, very careful. Those of us who have met the glamour before will keep an eye on you. I sincerely hope that we won't have a problem.
And Nightshade smiled. Not a particularly pleasant smile, Tiffany noticed.
Ladies, said Magrat to the others, trying to prepare them, to be a witch is to be full of yourself, and in charge of yourself as well. It would be a good idea to watch one another when the glamour starts to take hold.
Tish and pish, said Mrs. Earwig. I am my own woman, and always will be. I am a witch, whatever you might think, and I don't deal in fairy tales.
In a syrupy voice, Nanny Ogg said,
You just write them, Mrs. Earwig.
But not as reality, said Mrs. Earwig. That's allowed.
Nanny Ogg looked at her face and thought, We will see.
Ladies, asked Tiffany, are you all ready?
There were some nods and yeses, so she said,
Nightshade, please show us your glamour.
And she grasped the shepherd's crown in her pocket. This was a moment when she knew she would need to keep a strong hold on her sense of self. Yan tan tethera, she chanted softly to herself. Yan tan tethera. Nightshade began slowly, her foxy little dairymaid's face filling with a shining light, with beauty, with style. And then she was suddenly the most wonderful thing in the hall. Fantastic. Marvellous. Enchanting. Terrific. The air was thick with glamour, and Tiffany could almost hear the witches fighting it. The inexperienced ones, Anagramma, Petulia and Letitia, Dimity and Harrietta, suddenly seemed flaccid, their faces like dolls. Petulia, like many of the other witches, felt a beguiling feeling that the world was all hers, all of it, with everything that was in it. And then her dream, as did theirs, unravelled. Who did she think she was? No one liked her. No one wanted her. She wasn't worthy of anything. No one wanted her. Everyone knew she didn't have any skills. It would be so much better if she was dead. Maybe it would be better if she simply let the pig stamp her down into the mire, and even that wouldn't be bad enough. She screamed. Tiffany moved towards Nightshade, and almost like a bubble bursting, the elf let go, and her glamour was all gone. But everyone in the hall looked shaken. Except, Tiffany noticed, Mrs. Earwig.
So, what happened? The older witch snapped bossily. What are you all doing?
Mrs. Earwig, did you not feel as though you were small, nasty, and a waste of space, totally without redemption?
Lettice Earwig's face held nothing but puzzlement. Nightshade looked at her and back to Tiffany.
It was like hitting a rock, she said. This one has something interesting. Something missing.
She turned to stare again at Mrs. Earwig.
Are you sure you are not an elf? She queried.
How dare you! I am just Lettice Arwidge. No one can stop me being me.
Perish the thought, said Tiffany. But everyone else was affected. And that, ladies, was just one elf. Imagine what it will be like when we are facing a horde of them.
It was like seeing my father, said Geoffrey. I heard a voice telling me that I was no good and I never would be. A mouse, a maggot, no one worth crying for. He was never satisfied about anything.
His words sang into the room, and the witches' faces showed that each knew exactly what he was talking about. With the demonstration finished, and Nightshade back in her unassuming dairymaid guise, the bickering was almost over.
"Well, fellow witches, there we have it," Tiffany said. "We know who we are after and what we have to do, which is to keep the elves away from this world. It's very unlikely that we could kill them all," she hesitated. "What we have to do is make them see that dealing with us will not be easy, and it might be a very good idea to go back to where they came from."
"So," Queen Magrat said, "how long do we have to get ready?" Tiffany sighed. "We don't know," she said, "but they will come soon, I feel." She looked at Nightshade, who moved now into the centre of the room.
"The when," said the elf, "will surely be at full moon, a time of endings."
"Tonight, then," Magrat whispered.
"And if I know Peas Blossom," continued the elf, "the where will be on every front where the barriers may be weak."
"What do you think, Tiff?" said Naniog. "They've been coming into the chalk already, right? And they've been up here in Lanka through the dancers."
Nightshade nodded. "They will come through both those gates," she said, "and afterwards fan out," she shivered. Tiffany was taking charge now.
"Well, we're going to need to face them on two fronts, then, here in Lanka and over in the chalk." She looked around the room. "We'll have to split our forces."
"Well," said Naniog, "you can count on me. I've always been a fighter. You has to be a fighter to be a witch. We don't have to worry. They does. If you can get an elf down and kick it about a bit, it's not going to be so glamorous as it was. Take it from me. Even elves has soft parts which don't like no boot in them."
Tiffany glanced at Nanny's boots. They looked as though they had been built by a blacksmith, and in Nanny's case they probably had been. A kick from one of those, and it would be so long elf. It might not kill them, but you could certainly say that all the glamour would have been kicked out.
"They know where the stone circles are," she said, "but by thunder and lightning, they had better keep away.
After all, we know where the stones are as well, and we humans are clever, and we can sometimes be very nasty to boot.
When we need to, I suspect." She turned to Nightshade, who'd been watching everyone carefully. "What do you make of it, Nightshade?"
The elf smiled and said, "You humans are a strange people, sometimes soft and stupid, but also surprisingly dangerous. There are very few of you, and very many of the elves ranged against you. Yet I believe that traitor Peas Blossom has no idea what he will be facing, and I'm glad of that."
Tiffany nodded. Magrat, Naniog, the surprisingly strong Mrs. Earwig — there was more to Lettice Earwig, she realised, than the occult jewellery and fancy outfit suggested — the other witches of Lanka, Mrs. Proust, Geoffrey, and Mephistopheles. It would have to do.
"I think Lanka will be well served by you all," she said, looking around. "But I must go back to the chalk. It's my land."
"Who will you have to help you in the chalk, may I ask?" said Mrs. Earwig.
"Well," said Tiffany, "there's Miss Tick, a formidable lady, as I am sure you will all agree, who sends her apologies for her absence today. Or would, she thought to herself, if I could have found her again. Also, Letitia," she looked at the young baroness, who was trying to look brave, "and there's the land itself, of course. But remember, I have some other admirable allies. We are not on our own." She had been keeping an eye on the pile of broomsticks by the door, and even though they hadn't been invited, she could see the face of Rob Anybody, and by the look of it, a significant number of his clan. She laughed. They must have come up with Magrat and Letitia, she thought.
"Ladies," she announced, "please allow me to introduce the Knack Mac Feagles."
There was a susurration amongst the witches as the room started to fill with a sea of blue skin and tartan. Not all the witches had met the Feagles before. Tiffany heard Naniog whisper not quite quietly enough to Queen Magrat, "Put anything drinkable in the cellar."
"Ach, you're a cruel hag, so you are, and my name isn't Rob Anybody," Rob moaned.
Magrat laughed. "Rob Anybody? You are a war all by yourself, man. Welcome to the palace, but please don't drink everything. At least, not until we have won the war.
Now you're talking, lassie, I mean your queenship. Where there's a war, there's a Nac MacFeagle.
There was a barrage of cries of Crivens from the clan, and Rob Anybody shouted,
Aye, get them doon, and the kicking starts.
There was another cheer then, and Big Jan jumped up and shouted,
You will need to take note, ye weens. We dinna say yes to Mr. Finesse, but we just kick him.
Hamish added,
When Morag swoops doon on top of them, her beak and talons will take their breath away. And she's a heavy girl.
Be happy that they are on our side, Tiffany said. She looked reprovingly at Mrs. Earwig, who had a snooty look on her face. It's true that they are rough diamonds, but no better warriors can be found anywhere on the disc. And she hoped that Mrs. Earwig didn't hear the mumbling. Daft Woolly.
What's this? Did we stole any diamonds?
It's a manner of speaking, you dafty,
Rob Anybody.
But we got no manners. We treasured the fact you ken,
Woolly again.
It's an idiom. Who are you calling an idiom?
Tiffany laughed to herself. It appeared that the Kelder had been seeing to the clan's range of expressions. Rob waved his claymore in the air, making one or two witches retreat a step or two, and then he leapt up onto a table and glared down the hall.
"Weel, I see the Lady Nightshade is with us to noo," he said. "Ach, the big wee hag and the Kelder seem to think that we shouldn't do anything about this elf. We are to leave her alone. Although," he continued, looking at Nightshade, "we'll be watching her carefully, very carefully indeed. Wir Kelder is soft. Wir Kelder as soft as stone, ye ken. She is nae one to let a body break their troth and get away wi' it."
"My dear Sir Mr. Feagle," said Mrs. Earwig, "this is a council of war, so we should be discussing strategies and tactics."
"Ach, weel, ye can if ye wish. But we are Feagles, and we dinna mess about with things like that. It's all about using yon claymore to best offence. And if ye dinna get that right, your last resort is to nut 'em."
Tiffany took in Mrs. Earwig's face and said cheerfully, "Could you do that, Mrs. Earwig?" She was given a look, and Mrs. Earwig said, "A will nut as A see fit." And to Tiffany's surprise, the other witches applauded, and for once Mrs. Earwig was wreathed in smiles.
"I tell ye, I wouldn't cross young Carolyn," said Rob Anybody.
"Nay me," said Big Jan. "She's as sharp as a she-wolf."
"So where's yon battle, then, Hag of the Hills?" Rob demanded.
There was another roar from the assembled Feagles, and a forest of little swords and clubs were thrust into the air.
"Nac MacFeagle, wahey! A good kicking for the wee scunners! Nay, king, nay, queen, we will never be fooled again!"
Tiffany smiled. "If Nightshade is right, the elves will ride through this coming night, when the full moon shines in the skies. Ladies, and Geoffrey," she addressed the assembled witches, "go and get some rest. I must fly back to my steading now, but good night and good luck."
"Let the runes of fortune guide and protect us all,"
Mrs. Earwig added portentously, always determined to get the last word in. Tiffany loved the little room she'd had since she was a child. Her parents hadn't changed anything, and unless it was raining or blowing a gale, she slept with the window open. Now, weary from the broomstick ride back, tense with the expectation of what the night might bring, but hoping to get a few hours' rest, she savoured the atmosphere of the little room, finding strength from its familiarity. A strength that came from feeling that she was exactly where she should be, and aching. "I get up aching, and I go to bed aching," she whispered to herself, smiling. One of her father's jokes. And she had rolled her eyes when hearing it again and again as a child, but now its warmth curled over her body. And there was the china shepherdess on the shelf, Granny aching. And next to it she had placed the shepherd's crown, aching to aching, down the generations. Land under wave, she mused. That was what the name Tiffany meant in the speech of the Feagles. Tiafehin, Tifan, the Kelder would call her. The sound of her name was magic, real magic, from the beginning of time. It was a soft night. She told herself that she really ought to get some sleep. She'd be no good without some rest. But she lay there, the cat, Ewe, snuggled up against her warmth, listening to the owls. Hootings were coming from everywhere, as if they were warning her. Outside her window, the moon was rising, a gloriously full silver orb to light the skies, to lead the elves in. Tiffany's eyes closed. And a part of her, the soul of her, was in a chalk pit, the shepherd's crown in her hand, its five ridges catching the light of the full moon, and it was glowing, like an aquarium out of time. Now she could hear the roar of the ancient sea beneath her, its voice trapped in the millions of tiny shells that made up the chalk. And she was swimming. Great, strange fish were coming towards her, big and heavy-looking, with teeth. At that point, Dr. Bustle, part of him anyway, his memories being relocated to Tiffany's mind following an episode early in her witching life. The rather pedantic wizard's knowledge, especially of ancient languages, came in very handy sometimes, like when she wanted to read a peculiar menu in Ankh-Morpork. Dr. Bustle floated into her mind and took his cue.
"Dunkle Osteus," he said, as a creature the size of a house floated by. "Megalodon,"
was huge and carnivorous, more teeth than Tiffany had ever seen in one go. Then there were sea scorpions, armour-plated, clawed horrors. But none of them paid any attention to her. It was as if she had a right to be there. And then there was a smaller creature, an explosion of blue spines that did notice Tiffany.
"Echinoid," whispered Sensibility Bustle.
"That is correct," said the creature, "and I am the Shepherd's Crown. Deep in my heart is the flint, and I have many uses. Some call me the sea urchin, others the thunderstone. But here, now, in this place, call me the Shepherd's Crown. I seek a true shepherd. Where can a true shepherd be found?"
"We shall see," Tiffany heard herself saying. "I am Tiffany Aching, and my father is a king among shepherds.
We know him. He is a good shepherd, but not the best. You must find the king of shepherds."
"Well," said Tiffany, "I'm just a witch, but I will help you if I can. I work hard, mostly for other people."
"Yes," said the echinoid, "we know."
"I'm talking to a creature from under the sea," thought Tiffany. "Is that right?" First thoughts, not second thoughts, her mind reminded her.
"It is strange," said the voice of Dr. Bustle in her head, "but not so strange as falling down a rabbit hole with a pack of cards."
"Let me think about it," her second and third thoughts said. "If talking creatures from the sea turned up everywhere, we'd all know about it, so this must be something just for me." The voice came from nowhere, as though it was part of that ocean from time. Tiffany Aching is the first among shepherds, for she puts others before herself. And the shepherd's crown was warm in her hand, a golden light glowing from within its depths. An heirloom handed down from generation to generation of Achings, down to Granny Aching, on to Joe Aching, and now to Tiffany herself. Then the sea had gone, and she was back in the pit, but the magic was still there, for slowly, oh so slowly, she could see bones pulling themselves free of the chalk, rising to draw together to make two figures. Thunder and lightning, Granny Aching's sheepdogs, the best dogs any shepherd could ever have, dogs for the first among shepherds. Now they were at her feet, their ears pricked, and Tiffany felt as if she could almost reach out to touch them. Almost, but not quite. For if she should touch them, be part of them, would she too be drawn into the chalk to be bones like them? "Come by, thunder. Away to me, lightning," she whispered, the familiar commands filling her with courage. Then she was suddenly awake, back in her room, you draped across her feet, and an owl's huge eyes hanging in the dark of the trees outside. And someone was tapping on the window. While the moon shone gloriously full over the stone circles, lighting a path for her wayward children, who rode through in their splendour.